I almost got you with that mimic.
You never had me. You never had your car. I don't know why Vin Diesel's from Boston. That's the cold open.
I dig it.
Live from the Mundangerous Roof Deck in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 10 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
This week, we're talking about facilitating character goals and growth that fits both the story and the desires of the players. But first, the Morning Glory campaign faces powerful aberrations in their underground lair. And later, our sniper kills from afar in the Character Creation Forge.
So I noticed something a little bit different this week. You said sniper and not snipers.
That's correct, because we've just got the one.
We've received a lot of feedback about the Character Creation Forge, and
all of it good, right?
Yeah, everyone likes it, but they like different parts of it.
Oh, great. Okay, everyone's like, yeah, it's super good, but like, it could be better.
Yeah, some people are like, well, I don't really care much about the mechanics. I want to know more about the story behind these characters that you're building and these archetypes. And other people are like, well, I really love the mechanics. Don't change anything as it is. And still more people are like, I don't even play 5e. I just like listening to it. So we're trying a slightly different format this week. And we're going to try it for a couple weeks anyway, where we build one build of the archetype. And then we each offer a different story to sort of fit that character into a campaign.
And this actually works really well with an issue we were actually having with the Forge is that we would come up with an archetype, but there was only really one good build that fit it well. We kept being like, oh yeah, I was going to build that. But you two, I guess one of us could do a bad build.
Yeah, except that we kept voting for our own build. So neither of us is willing to admit which was the bad build.
Right.
But that's true. And the other thing that we've noticed is that we tend to gravitate towards certain groups of classes, certain combinations.
The fun ones.
Well, right. Or the most, you know, the most front-loaded. And that leads to very similar builds, even though we're applying different flavors. So we've thought we'll limit the number of builds and we'll just focus on the flavor.
That also allows us to actually collaborate on a build, which really isn't something that we've done on the show, even though it's something that we do in real life all the time.
Yeah, that used to be our whole commute home after game night was...
on the train, yeah.
How could we do this ridiculous thing in 5e? How can you kill somebody with a pebble from space?
It can't be done.
Darren's Instant Fortress.
Oh, hold on. But you got to get up there first, so teleport.
Ready to actions.
It's just a string of ready to actions.
Yeah. Think of the acceleration. If you could stack 1,000 Darren's Instant Fortresses on top of each other, ready your actions. That's a lot of distance you've traveled in 6 seconds, my friend.
When I'm the GM, there's no conservation of momentum. Okay, so sometimes there is. When it's worse for the players, there is.
I hate magical physics. All right, so speaking of when you GM, let's talk about the Morning Glory campaign and advance the next step of our recap.
So I just want to clarify one thing. I got a couple questions on Twitter. So just to clarify, the Morning Glory campaign is over. There's no actual play because we finished actually earlier this summer and we were playing for about 3 years before that, got 80 sessions. So we're doing a bit by bit recap rather than sitting here for 8 hours and recounting what we did over all that time.
Yeah, if you'd like to hear us actually play, we could consider doing that in the future, perhaps with an online game or something like that where it'd be a little easier to record. The truth is just the way that we play with our home group and the limitations of the space that we have and recording equipment and everything else, it just isn't feasible to try and do that with our group.
I would love at some point to do it on video.
Oh.
The game, I mean.
Oh,
right,
okay.
Right. I mean, the game as well.
Oh, this is speaking of Morning Glory.
All right. So the party met a bunch of different villains and then were betrayed, right? Betrayed by Nistrum and Zorlin de Caneth, who stole all of the Shardbound Fiends and framed you.
Betrayed is kind of a strong word for what they did. I think they didn't betray us. We grossly underestimated them.
Which surprised me, but it was good for Hook.
Look, I thought Nistrum could still be redeemed. I thought he might still be a loyal Inquisitor. I didn't know.
That's true. He was lying through his teeth to you. And, you know, as a paladin at that point, I think it was important for Bran's arc to, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt.
That was my mission, was to redeem him, not necessarily to kill him.
Right. And of course, you didn't know at the time that he was an unredeemable fiend.
And then my mission quickly changed to murder him.
Also, as a paladin, it should.
Right, right.
Yes.
The vengeance part of my paladin oath really came into effect after he sold us out to the Drow Queen.
Right. So Nistrum and Zorlan abscond with all of these shards and leave you guys hanging in the lurch. You chased down Zorlan and brought his head back to the Drow Queen, but she at this point still doesn't trust you, takes all your gold and throws you into Khyber, the Eberron version of the Underdark, because she's been locked in a 1,000-year-long battle with Dalkeir, an aberration overlord who is trapped beneath her village. And so she says, well, I mean, you're my prisoners anyway, so why don't you do me some good and, you know, stay down there until you die, but in the meantime, I guess you'll kill a bunch of aberrations.
I just want to note at this point that it was 2,000 gold, and I bore that bared?
Bore.
I bore that grudge for the remainder of the campaign.
Yeah, that was great for me.
I mean, I swore I was going back to get my gold.
And you did.
Eventually, but that's a different time.
All right, so the party is now trapped in Khyber, and the only way out is to go down. So it essentially becomes a dungeon crawl for a few sessions. So this episode, we're talking about character goals, and this was the time when I was trying to meet a few of the goals of a particular character. We've talked about her before, Lu, the great old one warlock, who believed that she was essentially a fallen entity of the Far Realm, of Zoriat, that was now trapped in this mortal form. And so I've talked about before how I personally don't really love aberrations or the flavor of aberrations. But, you know, we had a player who based her backstory on that. And so, of course, I was going to introduce that somewhere in the campaign. And this was a convenient opportunity for me to be honest, to railroad you guys a little bit. Because, you know, sometimes character goals are really disparate. Not everyone in the party is focused on the same thing or wants the same thing to happen. So in order for one person to kind of fulfill their destiny or, you know, find something out about their past, the rest of the party needs to come along with them. But depending on the personality of the characters, they may not necessarily want to. So I think at times it's certainly useful to just have the characters put in a position where they don't really have a choice. They sort of need to see this through, and the spotlight's not on them. It's on this one person for a little while, you know, a few sessions. So this was the point where Lu gets to hang out with her aberrations, and I got to use a lot of iconic aberrant monsters like Mind Flayers and Beholders. Who doesn't love fighting those?
I didn't love it.
No?
I got turned to stone.
Okay, but...
Which I actually quickly determined was the safest form to be in when you're fighting a beholder, because the death ray is...
The death ray, the disintegrate ray
is a nightmare.
There's both. They're both in there.
Oh,
yes.
They're both? Those are both things?
Yes. So, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. You didn't have to stay stone, right? I think at that point they could have turned you back into flesh.
They offered, and out of character, I was just like, no, that's cool. I'm going to go... Like, I don't smoke, but I'm going to go take a smoke break.
Right. So you basically abandoned the party.
That's, yeah. It's what my character would have done.
It is true. So at that point, Bran was still pretty new to the party. So he didn't yet have that sense of camaraderie or unity with the goals of the party. So yeah, it was sort of selfish in character, but I think it fit. So let's talk a little bit about the other motivations of the other characters that had been often dealt with so far in the campaign. There was Brand, of course, our Silver Flame Inquisitor, who's after Nistrum Shadar. And since Brand has arrived, this is basically all you've been doing in the campaign, chasing Nistrum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been met. Kallik, the survivor of Seer and the Day of Mourning, is trying to figure out what exactly happened to his country. And of course, the sort of entire arc of the campaign itself was to figure that out. So of course, that is being met. I feel comfortable there. Bastion the Warforged really just wants to kill things. And, you know, every session offers him that opportunity. So I'm feeling like his player is feeling pretty good about what he's doing.
Yep.
Emery, the Bard, her motivations at this point were a bit unsure. She was sort of tagging along, and part of that was Emery the character, and then part of that was the player not really feeling like she knew exactly where she wanted to go with Emery. So we'll talk about that a little bit later in the episode, but that was something that I was mulling at this point, you know, what to do to sort of help both the player and the character come to life a little bit more in session. And then Bahar, the Madani rogue, was very exploration focused, and he wanted to find out what happened to his parents, who he believed died in the Day of Mourning. But honestly, the combination of the player and the character were sort of ideal for a GM. I think a lot of you who run games sort of know this kind of player. They're interested in advancing the plot. Bahar was always the character that was like, oh yeah, here's an obvious hook. We should definitely follow this up, you know, because this will lead to more information.
Yeah, he actually found hooks that we overlooked. Some of the other players were so focused on their own directions that they were just missing the obvious. Kallik and Bran, for example, were biting hard on the Nistrum lead. And there were times when Bahar's player was just like, hey guys, we're overlooking something. Let's take a minute.
Yeah, I knew that I could sort of dangle a thread in front of him and he'd go for it. And the rest of you guys sort of would go along with it, because Bahar, the character, was... I know you probably don't feel like he was the leader of the party, but he certainly was the one who, at least early on, pointed the party in the direction it was going to go.
He was the instigator.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, he was the one who played around with the scenery until he found the book in the wall that opened the secret door, right? You need those kind of players to advance open plots.
Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about that type of character and player archetype in a little bit. But that means that there was one character in the party who was sort of tagging along but didn't really have any of her backstory melded into the plot, and that was Lou. So now here was an opportunity to really focus on, for a few sessions, aberrations. And, you know, the rest of the party gets to fight aberrations. That's great. Everyone wants to kill a Mind Flayer. And I think Kallik had a nice moment where he killed a Mind Flayer literally the, like, turn before it was going to eat Bahar's brain. That was definitely going to happen.
Yeah, Bahar in hand.
In tentacles.
Well, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, that was nice. That was good. But then in game, it was this opportunity for Lou to be around aberrations, to see how she responded to them, how they responded to her, have the rest of the characters sort of look between their companion and then these awful, horrible monsters and go, oh, they're really similar. That's a little weird and icky.
Yeah, it was a little creepy. Aberrations come with a lot of body horror.
Yeah, that's probably why I don't love them.
I'm with you, but you know, it is what it is.
So you had a few sessions of spelunking, a more traditional dungeon crawl, and then the party encounters Belashira, the Lord of Eyes, a nascent Dalkeer who is regaining her power. Oh, lo and behold, actually, it turns out it's a she and not a he.
That's fitting.
I went with it. That's actually opposed to canon. Canon, it's Belashira's male.
Oh.
Yeah. So, I thought it was an interesting twist on it, and also sort of played up the idea that, like, gender doesn't really have a meaning when you are, like, from beyond madness.
And you don't necessarily reproduce through conventional means, right?
Right, exactly.
I mean, aberrations are all magically created and manipulated creatures.
Right. So then Lou got to have her moment in session, that sort of temptation. Belashira says, join me and I will make you what you were. And I was open to Lou maybe doing that, and then, of course, inevitably fighting the party, potentially. Knowing the player, I didn't think that was going to happen, but you know, there was always the possibility that the player, that she would have said, okay, no, I think this is what Lou would do, and then the encounter then becomes you fight against her. Either there's a TPK, which I thought would be unlikely, or you know, you guys end up killing Lou, and then she brings in another character.
Yeah, and you did a good job with that as sort of the temptation. I mean, it was almost like a Garden of Eden kind of scene, where I think it was that when she touched Belashira was when she started gaining the visions or knowledge, and the longer she stayed touched, the more difficult it was for her to remove herself. And so as a party, we see this happening. We're like, we have to save Lou. And she's like, I can learn more. I can learn more. I can learn more. Right. It was it was kind of a tense moment, even though we weren't the ones driving the story.
Which is nice, because as a GM, you feel like, okay, the first step is getting your players to really care about their character. And I think that takes a few sessions, you know, where they will care if their character dies and they have to like build a new one. But it actually takes some work usually to get players to care about other people's characters, because you know, usually after a while in a campaign, the characters have spent more time together in the game world than the players have spent together playing these characters.
I mean, depending on the dynamics of your group, right?
Right. But even so, like, you know, if you've been playing, you know, a couple years, and still that's 4 to 6 hours a week for most groups. But often these characters are together 24/7, camping on the side of the road, you know, almost dying in front of each other. And I think it's important to try to impress upon your players that these characters have been through life or death situations together, that they really are entrusting each other with their lives, and that builds a certain kind of camaraderie, or at least it can build a certain kind of camaraderie. So it was nice for me to sort of see you guys sweating a little bit over, oh, are we going to lose Lou? So spoiler alert, they don't lose Lou. She shakes herself out of it, and all of you gang up on Belashira and just beat the hell out of her.
Yep.
But of course, then she collapses the cave on you.
Yeah, so through, I don't know, one of our previous encounters in the Ring of Storms, Lou basically had a scroll of meteor swarm.
She read an inscription. Earlier in the Ring of Storms, you came across like an ancient tablet that was written in Ignan, and anyone who made a particular kind of check and could read it then gained the ability to cast meteor swarm one time within a year and a day, which is an idea that I took from a 3.5 Eberron source book. Pretty overpowered, but you can only do it one time. And Lou was the only one who happened to pass the check to be able to do it. So she held it onto it for a very long time, and this is the time that she decided to use it.
Yep, right on the drow encampment.
which was directly above us.
Yes. And that caused everything to collapse and open the portal.
Oh, right. So actually, yeah, we should notice during the sort of temptation phase, Belashir was just trying to get rid of the rest of you so she could sort of absorb Lou. And part of it was, you know, you can leave. All of you can leave. Just get out of here. Tell me where you want to go, and I'll just open a portal, and you can go there. Just leave her. And the purpose of this choice was to sort of give you guys a little reward for the railroading. So you got thrown in the Underdark in Khyber, and you couldn't do anything about it. So, you know, multiple sessions, you guys are just sort of stuck here, and you can't pursue your own character goals. So at this point, I just totally opened it up in a very sandboxy way to let you guys decide. You could have said anywhere in the world and the portal would have gone there. But one particular character decided where you guys were going to go.
And we're going to tell you who that was and where we went next week.
So let's talk about character goals. Shane, what are some examples of good goals that a player or a character can have?
I would define good goals as goals that give the GM hooks that he or she can use to advance the plot or character development.
Yeah, and I think in general, these fall into two basic categories. There's the external ones, and these are the things that we usually talk about defining a character. You know, they want to defeat the villain, or maybe they just want to gather lots of loot, magic items, things like that. Or they want combat prowess, they want recognition, fame, power, all these sorts of things.
That's a lot of the motivations we use for our character creation forge,
right,
are around becoming the paragon of this archetype, right?
Right. And then, of course, there are internal motivations for a character, which is, you know, basically anything emotional. And there's, of course, you know, too many to list all of them, but almost any emotion can be the driving force of a character.
Oh, yeah. Love, revenge.
Mm-hmm. Hate, wrath, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. Did you remember that from your Bible?
And there you have it, folks, all the internal possibilities. But yeah, these are the goals that you create for your character that don't have any outside driver. The only one who will know when they have achieved this goal is the character themselves.
And of course, the GM, because you should be communicating.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. The player and the GM as well. But in world, only the character will know when they've actually completed whatever their, or satisfy their motivation, or whatever that is.
Right. But ultimately, I'd say that anything is a good goal as long as it's not a bad goal.
You want to avoid any goal that's either overly secretive or outright antisocial. Because remember, this is ultimately a cooperative game. So if you want to be peak murder hobo, paragon murder hobo, that's a bad goal. That doesn't play well with others. Or if you're an evil character who's trying to get your comeuppance.
Or an evil character, and as a player, you want to see them get their comeuppance.
Yeah, because the problem with that is the time it takes to establish the evil character makes it very difficult for the rest of the party to enjoy those sessions. So either it's a very short-lived character, or if you're ultimately kind of playing like sort of a bad guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and then, of course, mechanically speaking, you know, when that character gets that comeuppance, it's usually a bullet in the face.
Right.
So, great. Now we've got a, you know...
Reroll.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same thing for if you're playing any sort of spy character. If you're in deep cover, especially if it's for the BBEG, it can work if you have a decent kind of cover motivation that works for the party. And if you and your GM have some plan for redemption. Because as soon as it comes out that you're working against the party secretly, you've got to have some approach to reintegrate with the party, or you're getting a bullet to the face, or, you know, an axe, or whatever genre appropriate.
And at the table, you're probably going to get some Cheetos thrown at your face.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, any of these bad motivations or bad goals can be okay as long as there is a very concrete plan for redemption or growing out of it very quickly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You can have a character that starts as a murder hobo, or the backstory is, hey, they were a murder hobo. But like in the first or second session, they need to have some sort of crisis of conscience and then begin moving away from that.
I would say if you're a new GM or maybe even an intermediate GM, it's very hard to try and balance these things without making them take too much of the spotlight away from other characters. So just don't allow them.
Yeah. I mean, there are always obviously exceptions, but as a rule, yeah, don't.
You'll probably hear lots of exceptions, but you'll also hear the rule. That's pretty much every gamer horror story. I mean, most of those horror stories come from bad character creation.
Yeah, and a GM who's a little too relaxed with letting people come up with their own motivations.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
So as a GM, how do you facilitate creation of good goals by your players?
So I want to clarify that when we talk about character goals, we're also talking about player goals. You know, and you know, usually these are the same thing, but sometimes they can differ, right? You might have a haughty swordsman who really wants to perfect her craft, but you have the player who wants to see this character humbled so that they can grow from this experience. Those are certainly goods, but just while we're having this conversation, remember that they're often the same, but they're not always necessarily the same. So the way I like to think of it is these player desires, you know, the kinds of goals that a player wants their character to achieve or to at least pursue. It's not so much like ordering off a menu. You don't have, or you shouldn't have, players saying, okay, here's what I want to do, and here's the way that I want to do it, and here are the things that I want this character to experience so that they can grow in this particular way. They're not drawing a map for you so that you know exactly when they're going to feel or experience these things in the plot. It's less like ordering off a menu, and it's more like ordering a bespoke cocktail at a fancy bar, right? You sit down, the bartender asks you, what kind of flavors are you thinking about? What kind of mood are you in? What ingredients do you like? You offer some suggestions, and then they leave and make something for you that they make.
I never go to those kind of cocktail bars, but I'm sure they exist.
Wait, really?
Yeah, I play those games all the time.
It's the best. It's $15, but it's the best.
Right, yeah.
But there needs to be a give and take. You know, as a player, understand that you're offering suggestions for the kinds of things that you want your character to experience. And as a GM, understand that this is the flavor that this player wants. And so now you've got a bunch of different players with a bunch of different flavors, you know, mix them together, throw in a chicken bone, you've got a stew going.
Sure. So let's talk in slightly more concrete examples. So a character archetype and arc that I really enjoy playing is the holy hand grenade. This is the paladin who's looking for a cause to die for.
Starts off lawful stupid.
No, I mean, could start off however you want, right? It's the idea is that he believes he is fated to find a cause worth his death.
I see what you're saying.
In service of his god, he wants to die. So he is looking for that cause, and he's looking for that adventuring party or that evil that needs to be smited or whatever it is. That's what you're looking for. telling your GM that you want to play a paladin is great. Telling him you want to play a paladin with that kind of arc tells him, okay, I have somebody who's going to be fully bought in if I demonstrate enough, right? To get him on my plot, I just need to explain this is worth your sacrifice. So it's not specifying that, yes, I want to find the biggest, baddest, most evil person in the land and kill them. That's a little hard to work with and pretty direct, right? But if it's, I'm looking for somebody worth my death, it's a little more useful.
Right. And of course, this player isn't necessarily saying, oh, you know, at a particular time, I want this character to die. Or even, I want this character to die.
Maybe that's the compelling question for that character is, this is a really dangerous or bad situation. Is this my time? Like, is this all I can do with my life? Or is there more that I can do? Should I hold off?
Right. And I think something that we'll get into in a bit is that you don't need to come up with all of your characters' goals or motivations right off the bat, and they're free to evolve. So you have this holy hand grenade, and they believe that like they're supposed to charge into battle every time that there's a worthy cause with no regard for their own safety. But after being horribly scarred a few times, maybe they're going to be a little more cautious, or maybe their fervor will be even brighter.
Or perhaps after they do succumb to their wounds and the cleric saves them, how will they react to the cleric when they thought they were dying for their god and the cleric has prevented that, right?
Right.
But yeah, so that's a good example of how you can use a goal in your campaign. So let's talk about, these are social games. There's always, almost always, more than one player. So how do you shift the spotlight and balance multiple different goals?
So I think that's an important point, is that you really should be shifting the spotlight as a GM. You've got 4 to 6 different characters, all with their different motivations. And even if, you know, it's later in the campaign and the party is cohesive and they're all on the same page, the internal goals of the characters are still going to be different. And they're still going to have slightly different things in their backstories, loose ends that need to get tied up. So it's fine if you have a few sessions dedicated mainly to dealing with one character's issues, because the other characters have bought into this character's motivations as well, right? They're friends or at least compatriots. And of course, the rest of the players are also okay with that because they know that their time is coming around. And right. I think that's really what sets apart a cohesive campaign from just running a series of adventures or one-shots, is everyone knows that, you know, everything ties in together. And sure, we're trapped underground fighting horrible aberrations, and the end of this culminates with the warlock getting tempted by, you know, a horrible abomination. But the rest of us are learning something about her. We're learning something about the overarching plot, and this is going to be worth it in the end.
Yeah, and personally, my goal at the point that we were locked in Kyber was to get out of Kyber. So it seemed like if there's only one way forward, I might as well go along with her plot as well, right?
There's pretty much always an excellent goal, get out of Kyber.
Right, yeah.
And then, of course, later on, and you know, we'll cover that in future episodes, is there were other times when multiple sessions in a row were dedicated toward a different character.
Yeah, everyone kind of got their moment in the sun.
You know, it's important to sort of time it so that these scenarios mesh with the plot. When every character and every player should be invested in the plot. One, the player should be invested as a story, right? Everyone's sort of here to tell an interesting and coherent story together. And that the characters, of course, they're invested because for them, this is real life. They live here. You know, they don't have the option of not caring about this, because the things that are going on, the plot should really be relevant to their lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And of course, if that is the case, if the plot really is relevant to their lives, then moving that story forward is going to at least touch on their goals or motivations. Remember that the campaign is not a novel, but in a way, keep in mind that
don't say this. Please don't say that it is sort of a novel.
It's not sort of a novel. The only thing that might be the same is that it's not weird if the characters are the center of the story. They don't have to be, but if there's a coincidence that makes it so that, you know, two people's nemeses turn out to be the same person, or one of the characters is related to some important NPC and, you know, that was surprising. Coincidence or fate is not weird because the PCs are special. There's a reason that the story is following them around to begin with.
Right. Absolutely. But keep in mind that's dependent on the type of game you're playing.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're playing an epic fantasy, that's completely expected. If you're playing a more emotional kind of, you know, like drama system or something like that, maybe that's stretching it a little bit. So keep the sort of guidelines of the genre in mind, but I think that's definitely good guide.
Yeah, I would say even if you're playing a game that's, you know, more drama focused, the scale of the plot is going to be, you know, tighter anyway in a game like that.
Right.
Yeah. So within that scale, the PCs will still loom pretty large.
Yeah. All right. So how about the players who struggle with coming up with goals early in the campaign and want to keep it open-ended for later, or the character whose goals change over the course of the campaign, that the personality of the character or the motivations, they've maybe solved one existential crisis and now they're on to their next existential crisis. So how do you introduce new character goals?
Totally. I think this is very important to be able to do this. And there's nothing wrong with having a character that's kind of along for the ride at the beginning. You know, maybe they have an attachment to one or the other, or they just happen to be in the tavern at the time and they wanted a job. And then they have the chance to sort of develop these goals as things happen to them. But, you know, there are other reasons why a character may not have clearly defined goals at a particular time. And then it's incumbent upon the GM then to introduce them. So you might have, for example, a wallflower player who doesn't really feel comfortable with saying, here's what my character wants to do, and so that means the rest of the party should go do it. You know, and not that people with well-defined goals are necessarily doing that, but that might be a reason that a wallflower player may back off a little bit and not be so concrete with their motivations. So you can introduce a goal. So one thing I did with the bard, Emery, later on was introduce the complication that her soul had been sold by her parents before she was born. And that then became sort of a driving goal for her, was to get her soul back.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because at that point, like you said, she was along for the ride and you didn't make the decision for her. I mean, she easily could have said, well, you know, that sucks. You know, like, but we're already following along this path. It's pretty important that we continue doing this. My personal focus can't be on my soul. I can't take time away from this important thing that we're already working on to worry about my soul. So I'm just going to go on forward. And in a way, that's already declaring her motivation right there.
Right, exactly. So that, yeah, that would have been great if she was like, you know what, this is not important to me. That becomes very character defining. Like,
right, sure.
Yeah.
She's already made her choice. Yeah, I'll give up the whole afterlife.
Yeah, just to see this through. Great. Right. Now your player and the character are invested in this because you've sacrificed for it.
Right.
Yeah. It works also for indecisive players too. Some people just want to do everything and they don't really know where to focus. So you give them a motivation, or you give them a complication, and then that turns into a motivation.
And sometimes you have to keep giving them complications that lead them in the same direction. You know, just keep the shiny thing in front of them.
Right.
As long as the shiny thing is always leading towards the same direction, you can kind of deal with those players.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's just plot reasons. You may have a character who already has well-defined motivations, but, you know, some people are born great and some people have greatness thrust upon them.
Right.
And some people have bad things happen to them because, like, this is supposed to be an emulation of the real world. And sometimes stuff just happens.
And, I mean, sometimes characters or players create character goals that are just small, right? Mm. I mean, they could be very localized or regionalized goals that you can knock that out in early levels and they're going to need something else to keep them engaged in the campaign. Or, you know, sometimes that means it's time to sunset a character as well, but either way.
Right. You're going to need a defined goal for that character to walk off into that sunset.
Sure.
Right? There's got to be something out there for them. Yeah. I think sometimes you build a character where you think, okay, this is going to be like a big quest, and it actually turns out to be really solvable.
Yeah, thanks, GM. No, that's fine as a GM. You don't need them to take 20 levels to do it. You know, it's common in campaigns that you kind of hit a milestone somewhere in the mid levels around 10, and then you pick up a bigger plot. You figure out how that fit into something more large, grand, epic scale, and then you go chase that down.
Or, you know, yeah, they just sort of emerge naturally from the consequences of the story and the PC's actions.
That's the other thing, yeah, is that they have agency. So they're going to make decisions, and sometimes those tough decisions have long-lasting consequences that they might be reintroduced, or that you might be able to reintroduce to them later.
Right. So I remember in a 4E game that we played a while ago, there, oddly enough, there was a player who had a family.
Like, that's stupid. Always kill your family. Always. Orphan players cannot be manipulated.
So he had a wife and he had two children. And of course, one of his goals was he was out adventuring because he wanted to protect them.
Sure.
You know, like keep them safe from the horrors that were out there.
As you do.
Yeah. So, you know, take the fight to them. But around level 10, he found a safe place for them in a sort of planar fortress. And so they were safe. They were fine. He didn't have that motivation anymore. And of course, on the flip side, if his family had been killed, again, no motivation there.
Well,
maybe a different motivation, right? So you need a new one.
Right, sure. Right.
So that one, right, if your family is killed, that's an obvious new motivation. But, you know, what do you do when they're just safe now?
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do.
What would you do?
I would retire the character.
Really?
It depends on how attached I was to the character.
Well, and also probably what was going on in the story, right? Because he found himself in the middle of this sort of like multi-planar confluence of events that was going to have severe repercussions.
Yeah, you come down to that question of, like we said last episode, right? If you're a murder hobo and you're looking for loot, does it matter how much loot you have if the world ends?
Right, like, yeah, exactly.
How safe are you if the world is you, the whole world that you're trying to live in falls apart around your little pocket dimension?
Yeah, and so I would say sometimes giving your players and their characters a good option for motivation just means threatening them.
That always works.
Yeah. You know, if they're getting too complacent, if they're feeling safe and satisfied, it's time to shake things up.
Yeah, it's okay to feel safe and satisfied for a little while. Never let that become permanent.
Right. And of course, the best way to facilitate all of this sort of complicated motivational stuff is actual communication in real life between either at the table and sort of above the table, out of character talk between the players, or it can be done sort of multiple one-on-ones via email or whatever between each player and the GM. Either of those can work well.
Sure. We've talked about it on the show, I think, already, but I had that problem with Brand actually around level 10 or 11, kind of almost where we are in the campaign, where mm-hmm. I wasn't sure that his personal motivation of chasing down Nistrum, I wasn't sure that it made sense for him to stick with the party. Like, it seemed that they were chasing down a mystery that no longer involved Nistrum. And maybe it made sense for Brand to leave. You said that was fine. Stick it out for another couple sessions and see if you still feel that way. It ended up okay. Brand stuck it out for the rest of the campaign. But sometimes that happens, and that's okay. You know, if we hadn't had that conversation, I probably would have felt very much just kind of afloat.
Yeah, and actually this is the exact point, because it was after the party went through the portal that you were deciding whether or not you were going to keep Brand.
Right, because
or if reasons. You were going to, right, or if you were going to essentially retcon him because we had a more complete set of the rules at this point.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, so I think more communication at any point in the gaming process is good. That's how you make sure that everyone is having fun and that things are headed in a direction that everybody's happy with. There are going to be people who disagree with this. There's an old school mentality, which is fine, that...
But wrong.
That GMs are somewhat opposed to players. That GMs exist to challenge players, not necessarily to enable them. And if you're playing in that kind of campaign, and that's the sort of game you play, probably makes sense to hide your motivations a little bit from the GM. They might be used against you. I get that. But in general, I think you're going to end up running a better campaign, and I think you're going to have more fun as a player if you tell your GM what you want in simple terms.
Yeah.
Tell him what interests you for your character, and let him figure out a way to make that fun for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, part of the fun, I think, of being a GM is facilitating everyone else's fun.
Yeah, it is for me anyway.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm just a stinking hippie about that, but, you know, I think it's fun.
Everyone who knows you thinks giant hippie.
That's right.
Right. I mean, also, it's fun to throw 7 Tarrasques at your party. You won.
Do you hear that, Ishan?
Is that an 8th Tarrasque?
It is not an 8th Tarrasque. I believe it is time for the Character Creation Forge. But before we step into the forge, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from our listeners.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
You can also tweet at the show at TPTcast. Or you can email us if you can't fit it into 140 characters at totalpartythrill@gmail.com. And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrillCast.com.
So for the Character Creation Forge, we've got something a little bit different. We talked about it in the intro, but we've only got the one build. However, we've got two stories. So let's talk a little bit about the build, yeah?
Yeah, so you built off Rogue 17.
Yep, Rogue Chassis. So this is the sniper. The point of the build is to do as much damage as possible, or nearly as much damage as possible, from a distance in the dark.
Yeah, so you want to be far away, you want to be attacking from stealth, you generally don't ever want to be in harm's way, you're not a frontline guy, you are slow and methodical and setting up your target.
Right. So the key ability that we're building toward is Rogue 17, which gets you Death Strike if you take the assassin path. So a level 3 assassin gets the assassinate feature, which gives you advantage against any enemy that hasn't gone yet. So of course, if you're sniping, you are attacking someone who doesn't know that you're going to attack them. So you're going to get advantage on your attack, which is helpful for your accuracy. It also lets you crit if the creature is surprised, which again, they should be if you're stealthing properly. But then at 17, it gets even better. You get Death Strike, which forces a constitution saving throw by any creature that you hit when they're surprised. And if they fail, they take double damage, which when tied with assassinate means you're critting and then doubling that. So at level 17 with Death Strike and just a regular old heavy crossbow, you're doing 2d10 plus 18d6 sneak attack plus 15 in the double. That's an average of 164 damage on a failed save against DC 18 constitution.
Nice. That's enough at 17 or, well, that's actually probably going to be level 20 by the time you actually get all that. But that's roughly half of CR 20 creatures' hit points.
And lower level creatures, you'll just take them out. Like if you're facing multiple lower level creatures.
Yeah, or like any PCs.
So again, don't kill your friends.
Right, right.
Or I guess don't get dominated.
Right. Yeah, that's really what it is.
So elf for dex, perception proficiency, and then dark vision, which is totally key because none of this sneak attack damage works if you've got disadvantage on the roll, which you very well might if you're in the dark. And of course, if you're a sniper, you should be in the dark.
Yep.
Now, the key components of the build are a heavy crossbow because it does 1d10 damage. You can do a longbow. It only does a d8, but there are, you know, a few other options that increase your longbow damage, bracers of archery, things like that. And the sharpshooter feat. This lets you take a -5 to your attack roll to add +10 to the damage, which of course gets doubled if you are able to use Death Strike. Of course, this leaves you 3 levels, and there are a bunch of different options that we could have gone with. I am personally partial to Fighter, which gets you your weapon proficiencies, it gets you Archery Fighting Style, which gives you a +2 to all your attacks. A Champion Fighter at level 3, you can increase your crit range, that's nice. Or you can do 3 levels of Battlemaster for Trick Arrows, which I think is interesting and fun and gives you a lot of options in combat when you're not actually sniping alone.
So, sure.
Certainly makes you a lot more party friendly.
Yep.
And I think it's important to note that Rogue brings a ton to the table. You're totally a skill monkey, which means that even when you're not off on your own stealthing or whatever, if you carefully selected your expertise options, you can be a face if you want. You can be a sage. You can be the tracker. All different. You can be the grappler, actually. All kinds of options. We talked about that before.
Let's not be ridiculous. No one can be the grappler.
Grappler sniper. That's so good.
All right. So there are a couple obvious ways to add more damage that you have declined to take. So why not, for example, build off the warlock where you could have you could use hex and you could have a 1200 foot eldritch blast using spell sniper, right?
Right. Well, so we totally considered that, yeah. One problem is that you need a weapon attack in order for the rogue abilities to key. So, you know, you can get a pretty nice Eldritch Blast and you can hit from so far away, but you're probably not going to kill or severely damage an enemy. That's, you know, a fair fight in the first place.
Yep. So how about Cleric, for example? You get Bless at level one, and that will help offset your sharpshooter penalty.
Yeah, also super awesome, that extra D4. You can pick it up with Magic Initiate if you want.
So just not worth a whole level.
I mean, you could dip it. Of course, that's certainly a twist in your story, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I might start Cleric, get some heavy armor proficiencies.
Knowledge Cleric. No, don't take heavy armor. Take Knowledge Cleric and get two more expertises.
Oh, so you're definitely going the Sage route then.
I would, yeah.
So then why does a Sage turn into a sniper?
Know your enemy. And the Sage is a frail type character, right? So if you're going to contribute in combat, you want to do it from as far away from your enemy as possible.
Interesting. All right. All right. That makes sense to me. A sneaky cleric. You don't see a lot of those.
No. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in real life.
Right. Yeah. I don't see a lot of clerics, period. The Eagle Sight ability of the Barbarian for the Eagle Totem.
Love it. But six levels, yeah.
That's a big cost.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, that increased durability doesn't really help you.
Yeah, and the Barbarian itself is just a weird flavor for somebody who's very dialed into precision strikes from distance.
Mm-hmm.
The frenzy of the Barbarian just doesn't quite make sense. Rage, that person can't be consumed by rage, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about real-life snipers, you know, you're trying to slow your heartbeat down.
Right, right. Know? Not ignore all the damage because your heartbeat is so high.
Right. I would say the most important thing about a Barbarian to remember for this build is try not to kill one, because you know their resistance is really going to take down your damage, and they're totally going to succeed against the death save.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point.
So Shane, what's a good story for this character?
Well, I have to break the rules slightly, or bend the rules anyway. I like the Rogue 17 chassis that we started with, but I would actually take three levels of Ranger in place of the Fighter.
It's definitely a good option.
Yeah, and I would go for a Hunter.
Ooh, and a nice clean kill.
Exactly. Yeah. So at level three, you'll have Pass Without Trace, you'll have Hunter's Mark, you'll have Colossus Slayer, which all add extra damage. Colossus Slayer only targets if the... or only triggers if the target has already been hit, so it's good for subsequent rounds, not necessarily on your big shot up front.
It may not help on the snipe necessarily, but it also it's very useful every other time.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. Exactly. The other piece of that is favored enemy and the nature stride, right? Very flavorful abilities for somebody who is stealth-focused, survival-focused, in the woods, kind of shooting things from far away.
And that's very party friendly anyway. Speaking of which, so why does this character join a party? A hunter kind of seems like a loner who hangs out in the wild.
He is, and I think that's an important part of the character, is the connection in nature. The hunter, while he hunts animals in the woods, also recognizes he feeds his family from those woods. So a good way to bring them into the party, have the villain or BBEG somehow threatening his ancestral hunting grounds so that he is saving his home in the process of joining the party. And, you know, as he's sort of a party-friendly character, he can contribute.
So rather than just staying home and defending those hunting grounds, he's deciding to take the fight to the source.
If he believes the party has a chance of winning, he would want to pitch in to help, right? I mean, that's sort of the nobility of the hunter.
So maybe the early levels are those three levels of Ranger. He's a hunter, right? And then the party helps him defend his hunting grounds. And then sort of as recompense, he joins them for a while and then gets tied into the story.
Sure. And especially the way that we just talked about a great way to add motivations for a character, sort of plan this in advance, right? Have the BBEG directly threaten his hunting grounds. Maybe the BBEG is doing something terrible to the animals within, or a blight is killing the land or something like that. The sort of things that would rile up druids also work for the hunter.
Yeah. Ranger's just a damage-focused druid.
Sort of, yeah.
Well, maybe not in 5e.
Yeah, it's yeah. That's we don't need to get into that. We've tried to save the ranger already, sir.
That's true.
So that's my character. That's my story reason for having the sniper. What's your build, or what's your archetype?
So I kind of call her a sniper savant. She's dex-based, obviously, but the secondary stat is int, intelligence, because I view her as dedicated to the craft of the kill. So I see her as having a very strong code in terms of what she's willing to hunt. So she is a mercenary, but she refuses most jobs. She feels like there needs to be either a challenge in it, or, you know, there needs to be a noble purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I definitely see her feeling like every job that she takes is honing her skills.
So if she is focused on the job, then one challenge as a GM might be, or even as a player, is how do I keep this character engaged with the party?
Yeah, I definitely see this character as one of those that sort of starts out with an attitude problem and then gradually develops camaraderie with the party, comes out of her shell. So I'm thinking of her as sarcastic and cynical.
Sort of acerbic.
Yeah, exactly. Not very jolly, kind of tight-lipped, because what she's really focused on is the craft. So she ceases to be challenged by the hunt pretty early on, which makes Rogue a really natural turn for her, because she is deciding to turn to some book learning. Rogue lets her grab a bunch of skills and then specialize in them. So when she joins the party, sure, you know, she's a really good sniper and actually gets better at it while developing her rogue skills, but she also becomes more of a sage character. She spends time in the library. She works on those knowledge skills. So when the party needs to look up some lore that has nothing to do with killing, she has those research skills that are still really helpful. And then, you know, she finds that that's something that becomes really interesting to her. It opens her up to a wider world. And then that's an opportunity for her to start thinking about not just how she's killing, but then also why she's killing and who she's doing it for. It opens her up to larger purposes.
Well, speaking of single-minded focus and not having a lot of friends...
Hey, now.
You can find our show on iTunes. and if you would be so kind as to give us a 5-star review on iTunes, we will read it aloud on the show, and we will get to a couple of reviews that we have in just a few minutes. If you don't use iTunes, you can also find us on Stitcher. Stitcher is like a Pandora for podcasts, where its algorithm recommends shows... new shows to you based on the shows that you've told it you like. So if you give us a plus or a thumbs up on Stitcher, that will help us a bunch. As I said, we have two reviews to read today. The first is from our friend Dan.
Here in New York.
Yeah, he's in Long Island. So, and Dan has actually sent us an email as well and asked us a question. We're actually going to talk about it a little bit next episode. But before that, this is 5 Stars by Dan Lorbard. Long Island, New York. Podcasts are essential to my daily routine, and Total Party Thrill is a new favorite of mine. My DM, Matt, recommended it to me, and hopefully the rest of our 5e group will listen in as well. Ishan and Shane's pacing and banter are great, and the main idea of each episode is fleshed out real well. Great for beginners, experienced players, DMs, and PCs. Hopefully this podcast is going to be around for a long time. I couldn't agree more, Dan, and thank you for that kind review. So, Ishan, what's our other review?
Our next review comes from Big Jack Heart Attack.
Which, that's an awesome name, by the way.
It's pretty sweet.
Yeah. It feels like a oversized burger that you would buy at Arby's.
Here's what I want to say. I want to say at some point in the future, I would like the character creation forge to be based around the name Big Jack Heart Attack.
We'll figure that out. We can do this.
Yeah, totally doable.
All right. But before that, he has a review.
Yes, indeed. This review is titled Crunchy DM-Focused D&D 5e Advice and Experience Podcast. 5 stars by Big Jack Heart Attack. The format, sound quality, and co-host dynamic is great right from the get-go. This is a podcast that developed well in utero, so you don't have to waste your time listening to 10 episodes as they improve their structure or audio quality. My only complaint, and it's small, is during their Character Forge segment, I wish they would tie fluffy examples to their crunchy decisions. For example, an opportunity was missed in Combat Medic Bard that, beyond the mechanical identity, they could have explained how the Bard worked as a combat medic thematically. Patch Adams versus Civil War Drummer Boy.
So that's really good feedback, and that's something we totally missed. When we read that review, we looked at each other and we're like, crap! The drummer boy, or like the bagpipe player in the Scottish Highlanders, like That's amazing. So that's great feedback. Thank you, Big Jack Heart Attack.
And we hope that you've enjoyed this latest character creation forge because it grew basically out of this kind of feedback.
We're nothing if not responsive. So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We'll be talking about the social contract at the table.
And in the character creation forge?
We're building a scummy lawyer.
That seems like there's a theme. All right, well, that's it for episode 10 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we've lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.